Today is Friday, October the 10th, and you are listening to the World Socialist Website. Fascist gathering in the White House signals mass repression and violence. By the Socialist Equality Party, US. All the events of the past month, since the killing of Charlie Kirk, the transformation of a fascist provocateur into a martyr of the MAGA movement, the mobilisation of the National Guard against the so-called enemy within, and the open preparations to invoke the Insurrection Act, have demonstrated beyond any doubt that what is underway is a systematic conspiracy by the Trump administration to establish a dictatorship. Blinders are falling from people's eyes. More and more Americans are saying, "I don't recognize this country anymore." The land of Lincoln is being transformed by Trump and his arrogant satraps into the land of a would-be Führer. This conspiracy entered a new and chilling stage on Wednesday when President Trump convened a meeting in the White House that was presented as a roundtable on Antifa. It was, in fact, a gathering of extreme right-wing political maniacs, neo-Nazis, Christian nationalists, racists, and Hitler lovers. They were assembled by Trump in what was clearly intended as a signal for all-out war against political opposition. An atmosphere of menace and imminent violence prevailed throughout the entire discussion. Nothing like this has ever occurred in the history of the United States. The White House has been transformed into the headquarters of a conspiracy to legitimize fascism, brand anti-fascism as terrorism, and mobilize the repressive machinery of the state against the population. Seated alongside senior government officials, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, Attorney General Pam Bondi, Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, Senior Advisor Stephen Miller, and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent were a collection of neo-Nazi agitators masquerading as journalists. The most repulsive of these aspiring executioners was Jack Posobiec, a neo-Nazi whom the Southern Poverty Law Center has described as having collaborated with white supremacists, neo-fascists, and anti-Semites for years. At the White House meeting, Trump declared that we got rid of free speech and denounced protests involving millions, including the upcoming October 18 No Kings demonstrations, as paid operations directed by a vast left-wing terror network. The various fascist personalities singled out the Democratic Socialists of America, Code Pink, and other groups as accomplices of Antifa. Trump accused Democratic governors and mayors of acting illegally, calling for their arrest and warned them, in the style of a mafia boss, to be very careful. Noem claimed that the supposed Antifa network is as sophisticated as ISIS or Hezbollah, while Attorney General Pam Bondi vowed to take them apart brick by brick, to destroy the entire organization from top to bottom. All those assembled at the White House agreed on the need to designate Antifa as a foreign terrorist organization. This would sanction political repression and violence all the way up to assassination and mass murder. But Antifa is not an organization at all. It has no central leadership, no membership roles, and no structure. When the Trump administration declares war on Antifa, it means this literally: a war on anti-fascism itself, the criminalization of all opposition to dictatorship and repression. During the discussion on whether to brand Antifa a foreign terrorist organization, Trump turned directly to Posobiec and asked, "Would you like to see it done?" The fascist propagandist, who served as a key figure in the January 6 coup attempt, responded enthusiastically in the affirmative. In his book, Unhumans, The Secret History of Communist Revolutions and How to Crush Them, with a foreword by Steve Bannon and a blurb from Vice President J.D. Vance, Posobiec portrayed all revolutionary movements over the past 250 years to be the work of subhuman monsters. Leftists operate from envy, Posobiec writes. There is no way to reason with those who manipulate the have-nots en masse to loot and to shoot. If it is impossible to reason with unhumans, they must be dealt with through other means. Democracy has never worked to protect innocents from the unhumans, he writes. It is time to stop playing by rules they won't. This is an open call for violence against opponents of Trump. Posobiec's language is lifted directly from the vocabulary of the Nazis. His unhumans are a close translation of the Nazi term, Untermenschen, subhumans, used to justify genocide against Jews, Slavs, and other peoples. In 1942, SS leader Heinrich Himmler oversaw the publication of a pamphlet titled Der Untermensch, which declared that certain populations were biological creatures, who are only partial human beings. Posobiec's unhumans, like Himmler's Untermenschen, are those marked out for annihilation. What we need are lists, he wrote. Lists of enemies, along with men and women of action, to hunt down opponents in the media, education, and the economy. Let cultural Marxists tremble in fear. At the CPAC last year, sharing the stage with Bannon, Posobiec declared, "Welcome to the end of democracy. We're here to overthrow it completely. We didn't get all the way there on January 6th, but we will endeavour to get rid of it." Posobiec also told Trump during the White House event that Antifa has existed since the Weimar Republic in Germany, that is, since opposition to the rise of Hitler. This is a theme promoted by others in attendance, including Andy Ngo, who, in his book Unmasked, complained, "While the brown shirts are well remembered in contemporary Western society, the history of far-left paramilitaries in the German interwar years has faded to memory." Hours after the fascist gathering, Mark Bray, a Rutgers University historian and author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, was stopped from boarding a flight from Newark to Spain on Wednesday night. Bray, who had received death threats from Turning Point USA activists and was labelled by Posobiec a domestic terrorist professor, was attempting to leave the country with his family. After passing through security, Bray was informed at the gate that their reservations had been cancelled. He wrote, "Someone cancelled my family's flight out of the country at the last second. We got our boarding passes. We checked our bags, went through security. Then at our gate, our reservation disappeared." The only explanation for this cancellation is that someone in or around the administration sought to prevent Bray's ability to leave the US and escape from the threats against his life, and to send a message that he is being followed and targeted. One might have assumed that the invitation of fascists to the White House, where their calls for the political suppression and violent overthrow of constitutionally protected rights were endorsed by the president, would have been met with a storm of protests. But nothing of the sort has happened. The open embrace of fascists in the White House has been met with near total indifference from the political and media establishment. No leading Democrat, including House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, or Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, has issued a single statement on the gathering of neo-Nazis and white supremacists in the executive mansion. The major network TV news programs gave it no coverage. The Washington Post, the principal newspaper covering the nation's capital, has nothing on the front page of its website. The New York Times, the main media organ of the Democratic Party, published only a perfunctory report focused narrowly on Trump's false claim to have taken away freedom of speech, omitting any reference to the fascistic threats and declarations made by the participants. The silence extends to the various organisations that operate in and around the Democratic Party as well. Jacobin magazine, the organ associated with the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, has published nothing on the White House's fascist meeting. The invocation of the Insurrection Act, all the threats against Bray, and the cancellation of his flight. The DSA itself, which was explicitly threatened at the White House meeting on Antifa, posted a brief pro forma statement Thursday afternoon. "DSA affirms our fundamental right to free speech and assembly. We will not be intimidated by the Trump administration's cronies, and we will continue our struggle for democracy to the end." The DSA says that it will not be intimidated, but if that is all they have to say in response to a direct threat from the White House, then they plainly are. Moreover, the issue is not only the fundamental rights of the DSA, but the overthrow of the Constitution and the establishment of a dictatorship. Nowhere does the organisation explain how its proclaimed struggle for democracy is to be waged. Because for the DSA, the answer is always the same. To subordinate opposition to the Democratic Party, which, through its silence and inaction, is enabling Trump's coup. There is enormous popular opposition to Trump's dictatorial agenda. Millions are preparing to take part in the upcoming No Kings demonstrations on October 18th, with more than 2,100 protests already scheduled in cities and towns across the country. The administration's threats, its deployment of troops to major cities, and its plans to invoke the Insurrection Act are preemptive moves against the developing movement of the working class and youth. There is every reason to believe that the Trump administration will seek to incite violent incidents to provide a pretext for repression. All those who are planning to participate in what are planned as peaceful protests must be on guard against and avoid falling into traps laid by provocateurs. However, the demonstrations, motivated by profound determination to defend democratic rights, must confront critical political and strategic truths. First and foremost, the assault on democratic rights is aimed against the working class. In the final analysis, Trump is seeking to create a political system in which workers are deprived of all means to defend their most basic social interests. His administration's program is being implemented in the government shutdown, now in its second week. Trump is boasting of exploiting the opportunity to destroy hundreds of thousands of jobs, gut social programs, and strip millions of healthcare, housing, and retirement benefits. The same government that is deploying troops in American cities is spearheading a social counter-revolution against every gain won by the working class. Second, Trump does not act as an isolated individual. He speaks and acts for the American capitalist oligarchy, which has concluded that its wealth and power can no longer be maintained through democratic means. The corporate and financial oligarchs, who dined last month at the White House and showered Trump with praise, are motivated by the same interests which led ruthless sections of the German ruling class to raise Hitler to power in 1933 and support his dictatorship. The mega-billionaires are convinced that the capitalist system requires a massive reduction in entitlement programs and overall living standards of the working class. Moreover, they want the elimination of all restraints on the use of military power to secure their global economic interests. Trump has been placed in the White House to implement this fascistic program. Third, the Democratic Party will do nothing to oppose this drive. Whatever tactical differences it may have, it is also an instrument of the financial corporate oligarchy and the military intelligence apparatus, and shares Trump's basic goals: the defense of capitalist wealth, the prosecution of war, and the suppression of any movement from below. Its silence and complicity expresses its class character. What it fears above all else is a movement of the working class that would threaten the foundations of capitalist rule itself. From the recognition of the situation as defined above, it follows. Fourth, the defense of democratic rights requires the independent political mobilization of the working class, the only social force capable of halting the descent into dictatorship. It numbers in the hundreds of millions, exercises the decisive role in the economic process of production, and has the potential power to bring the oligarchs to their knees and force a massive and democratic distribution of power and wealth. Moreover, the vast American working class is part of an international working class that makes it possible to wage the struggle against capitalism on a global scale. The October 18th protest demonstrations should mark the beginning of a counter-offensive against Trump's dictatorial and fascistic rampage. The Socialist Equality Party, SEP, urges that in every workplace, factory, neighbourhood and school, workers and student youth must begin to discuss and organise resistance to the assault on democratic rights. The savage assault on immigrant workers and their families must be stopped. Moreover, all political organisations and individuals targeted by the Trump regime must be defended. For its part, the Socialist Equality Party will defend all victims of government attacks, regardless of differences over program and strategy. Rank-and-file committees must be formed to coordinate this struggle across industries and borders. The SEP has taken the initiative to develop the fight through the formation of the International Workers' Alliance of Rank-and-File Committees, the IWA-RFC. The fight for this strategy and program among the youth is being conducted by the International Youth and Students for Social Equality, the IYSSE. The fight against dictatorship is inseparable from the fight against capitalism and for socialism. To defend democracy, the working class must take power into its own hands, expropriate this financial oligarchy, and reorganise economic life on the basis of human need, not private profit. Only in this way can the descent into fascism and dictatorship be stopped. Ceasefire deal includes permanent Israeli occupation of Gaza, by Andre Damon. Israel and Hamas announced Thursday the formal adoption of a ceasefire agreement involving the release of all hostages held by Hamas and the permanent Israeli occupation of Gaza. Hamas political chief Khalil al-Haya announced, "An agreement has been reached to end the war and aggression against our people." In reality, the agreement is yet another step in the Israeli imperialist plan to dominate Gaza and suppress the national rights of the Palestinian people. It turns Gaza into a colonial protectorate, supervised by a board led by the American president, and involves the permanent Israeli occupation of a large portion of Gaza. Al-Haya declared that, "We received guarantees from the mediators and from the US administration, and everyone confirmed that the war has completely ended." The very people providing these guarantees, however, facilitated the Israeli bombing of Qatar last month that tried to kill Al-Haya. The government of Saudi Arabia hailed the agreement, declaring, "This important step will lead to urgent action to alleviate the humanitarian suffering, achieve a full Israeli withdrawal, restore security and stability, and initiate practical steps to achieve a just and comprehensive peace based on the two-state solution." It will do no such thing. It will only cement the illegal Israeli occupation of Palestine and permanently position Israel to strangle Gaza's food supply in order to facilitate and continue its plan to ethnically cleanse Gaza. A particularly foul role has been played by bourgeois nationalist governments in the Middle East and the broader region, including Egypt, Jordan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates, which endorsed the deal and agreed to implement it. As a part of the agreement, Israeli forces will withdraw to a so-called yellow line, amounting to 58% of Gaza. In the very last stage of the agreement, Israeli forces would retreat to a buffer zone in which they control all land crossings into Gaza, leaving the population subject to the threat of further deliberate starvation. The deal inscribes a return to the open colonial domination of the Middle East that prevailed in the 19th century. Under the proposal, Gaza is to be governed by a board of peace that would be headed and chaired by President Donald J. Trump and include former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair. The Washington Post gloated that the agreement is a Hamas surrender and a Trump triumph. It boasted, "Call this deal what it is, a total Hamas surrender. That is worth celebrating." The Wall Street Journal joined in the gloating, declaring, "Hamas is giving up its best leverage, but Israel isn't. Even after the hostages are ransomed, Israeli soldiers will remain in more than half of Gaza, including by the Egyptian border." It concluded, "In accepting these terms, Hamas effectively acknowledges its defeat." As the Wall Street Journal made clear, the pause in the fighting will create the conditions for the next offensive. If the new Gulf Arab-led stabilization force to be deployed in Gaza fails to disarm Hamas and demilitarize the strip, Israeli troops will be in position to do so themselves with what Mr. Trump calls full backing. The Wall Street Journal added that the last month's Israeli attack on Qatar helped to influence the Arab governments to accept the deal. The newspaper counseled Trump to show the same aggressiveness he has used throughout the Middle East to escalate the US war against Russia. It declared, "If Mr. Trump now reverses his strategy on Russia, next year even the Nobel Committee might find it impossible to deny him the Peace Prize." condemning the peace agreement when it was first announced, the International Centre of Justice for Palestinians, the ICJP, wrote, "The plan's inclusion of an international board of peace ensures the exclusion of Palestinian voices from the decision-making of Palestinian futures." Orlaith Rowe, a spokesperson of the ICJP, noted, "This plan offers Israel yet another opportunity to pause, rearm, and then return to violence with renewed impunity." He added that it is steeped in colonial rhetoric. The Associated Press reported that the United States would send an additional 200 troops to Israel to monitor and oversee the agreement. The two-year-long Gaza genocide has led to the deaths of at least 65,000 Palestinians and the destruction of the vast majority of buildings in the enclave. Gaza has been shattered, and its population has been starved. A study published in The Lancet this week estimated that 55,000 children in Gaza are acutely malnourished. Among the children surveyed, 16% showed signs of wasting caused by lack of food. Unprecedented circular deals inflate AI bubble, by Nick Beams. Warnings that a major AI bubble has formed, or is rapidly in the process of formation, as OpenAI announces a series of deals with chip suppliers to build its computing power, are coming thick and fast. The alarms are being sounded because the deals involve a high degree of circulatory Webby, in one form or another. The supplier of the chips and technology provides financial assistance to OpenAI to enable it to purchase its products. According to calculations by the Financial Times, the FT, the results of which have been widely circulated, deals done by OpenAI, the maker of ChatGPT, with AMD, NVIDIA, Oracle, CoreWeave, and other smaller companies, amount to about $1 trillion in cost. The company will need more than 20 gigawatts of computing power over the next decade, with the electricity needed to power it equivalent to the output of 20 nuclear reactors. As the FT reported, OpenAI is burning through cash on infrastructure, chips and talent, with nowhere near the capital required to fund these grand plans. The company has yet to make a profit, and its founder and CEO, Sam Altman, has said that profit-making is not really on his horizon at the present. Speaking earlier this week, he said becoming profitable was not in my top 10 concerns. Obviously, he continued, someday we have to be very profitable, and the company will get there, but right now it was in a phase of investment. In other words, it is taking a $1 trillion gamble that the massive investments will eventually pay off. But others say a different dynamic is at work. As Gil Luria, an analyst at the investment bank and financial services firm D.A. Davidson, told the FT, OpenAI is in no position to make any of these commitments. It was expected to make a loss of around $10 billion this year. Part of Silicon Valley's fake it until you make it ethos is to get people to have skin in the game. Now, a lot of big companies have a lot of skin in the game on OpenAI. Their connection has been established through the circular deals through which OpenAI is being financed. Under the $100 billion deal with NVIDIA, the leading maker of the graphic processing units, GPUs, which form the basis for the development of AI, the money it supplies to OpenAI will be used to buy more NVIDIA chips. While Altman has said the deal with NVIDIA is a new financing model, it is very much a repeat of the kind of circular deals which were made in the dot-com bubble at the start of the century before it collapsed with billions of dollars in losses. And the deal with the chipmaker, AMD, has added a new twist to the circularity. Under the agreement, AMD will provide OpenAI with warrants to buy up 10% of the company's shares for just 1 cent a share provided certain targets are met. As the price of AMD shares rises, OpenAI will be able to cash in and use the money to buy AMD chips. AMD chief executive Lisa Su described the deal as a pretty innovative structure which didn't come lightly. In essence, the agreement means that the whole operation is being financed on the expectation that the surge in high-tech and AI stocks will continue indefinitely. Long-time Wall Street short seller Jim Chanos, who described financial markets as having entered the golden age of fraud back in 2020, and who commented recently that this phenomenon had done nothing but gallop even higher since then, pointed to one of the key contradictions in the circularity deals. In a social media post on the AMD deal, he wrote, "Don't you think it's a bit odd that when the narrative is demand for compute is infinite, the sellers keep subsidizing the buyers?" There is a clear recognition that an AI bubble, a situation characterized by the complete divorce of market valuations from underlying real economy, is fast developing. As well-known financial journalist Andrew Ross Sorkin noted in the New York Times this week, he was asked about this issue multiple times a day at a meeting in San Francisco. His answer was that we just don't know when it will end. When the dot-com bubble popped, it wasn't the end of the internet. It just meant that the weakest companies didn't survive. And that's probably what will happen again. A similar position has been advanced by ultra-billionaire Jeff Bezos, the founder and chairman of Amazon, who has acknowledged that there is a bubble, but this is good because it is a kind of industrial bubble. The basis of his claim and that of Sorkin is that, like the internet, the development of AI will ultimately be a positive economic development. And indeed, it would if it were being advanced in a rationally organized society with conscious planning. But it is being developed within the framework of capitalist social relations and a financial system increasingly dependent on speculation and parasitism, in which the mechanisms being used to finance AI are more akin to a Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme than anything else. Moreover, the blithe reference to the collapse of the dot-com bubble as just some kind of shakeout of weaker elements, and that the collapse of the AI bubble will be just a repeat of that earlier experience, ignores both what happened then and the changes that have taken place since. As an article by Ian Harnett in the FT noted, the bursting of the internet bubble saw Microsoft lose 65% in market value, Apple 80%, Oracle 88%, and Amazon 94%. Under present conditions, in which high-tech stocks comprise an even greater proportion of market capitalization than they did at the start of the century, up to 40% of the S&P 500 index, any repeat would be devastating. AI companies have accounted for 80% of the gains in US stocks so far this year. And in the quarter century since the dot-com bubble burst, the financial system as a whole has become ever more dependent on debt. Furthermore, AI investment is playing a central role in the growth of the economy. According to calculations by Harvard economist Jason Furman, investment in information processing equipment and software was responsible for 92% of all GDP growth in the first half of this year, meaning that the rest of the economy was essentially flat. Commenting on the AI surge in the FT, Ruchi Sharma, the chair of Rockefeller International, said that America has become one big bet on AI, and the US and its markets could lose the one leg they are standing on. The Bank of England has added its voice to the growing warnings. In its latest quarterly financial stability update, it said stretched valuations for equities, and in particular AI companies, together with the loss of independence by the Federal Reserve and increased corporate failures, had fueled the risk of a sharp market correction. For these articles and more today, visit the World Socialist website, wsws.org. This has been John Davis.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. the World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.